Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Ron Gibbs, David Masiotra, and Mark Miller. Our program tonight, coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us from our studios on State Street, that great street. Our toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And we have a new Twitter handle tonight. All you have to do is go to Dumo. D-U-M-O, first four names of Dumo, letters of Dumont, D-U-M-O, at Dumo. And again, if you have a question or comment, we're going to try to engage those as part of the program unfolding this evening. But again, nice to have you with us. It is a very busy day. There are many in this country that are celebrating the release of Bo Bergdahl, a U.S. Army sergeant who is released from captivity of the Taliban. He's in a hospital in Germany as we speak. He hasn't gone home yet. It'll be a long time before he gets home to his family in Idaho. He was released after 5 years of captivity. There is some controversy involving how it all began and also whether or not he should have remained silent when he was held captive. That's part of the controversy. The other bigger part of the controversy is that that release came when five major Taliban terrorists were released from Guantanamo Bay. Republicans are already up in arms about this. And again, there's been reaction already. In fact, Mullah Omar, who was one of the leaders of the Taliban, had this to say: "We shall thank Almighty for this great victory. The sacrifice of our Mujahideen have resulted in the release of our senior leaders from the hand of the enemy. May Allah grant all of them with rewards." And again, that's the first reaction from the Taliban leadership. Anthony Anderson, you're one of our Republicans tonight. You're a Marine Corps veteran. You've served Desert Storm, Desert Shield. Are you elated that one American soldier is now on his way home and in safe hands? Or are you concerned about the price that was paid to get him out?
No, I am elated to see that one of our own have been freed from this captivity for the last 5 years. I'm saddened, though, to see that some of the Republicans in the Congress are saying some things about how they should have been notified at least 30 days prior to this actually taking place. I mean, at what point would you come forth with some sort of solution as opposed to, you know, complaining about this American being released?
Ron Gibbs also joins us, a Democrat, but also a Vietnam veteran. Nice to have you with us, Ron. Your reaction.
Oh, I think it's great that he's home, and the whole motto of, you know, we don't leave our soldiers on the battlefield, we bring them back, and bringing him back is a great thing. And I think the naysayers, I just would say, if it was your son or daughter who was captive, you would be very, very happy today to have them home. I think in retort to that, for the Taliban's criticism that their day will come, well, we've got our troops back, and we're strong, and our day is still here, and we'll be ready to fight on.
Mark Miller from DePaul University, another one of our Republicans. Do you see things differently?
Slightly. I'm certainly glad he's home. But, you know, they had 5 years to prepare for this. I think it's just another indication of the incompetence of the administration to deal with such matters. They know by law they must get Congress involved in any kind of trade like this. They maybe knew, they have known for some time that this was coming. Why didn't they call in the leadership, say, we're going to do this, let's work together, and it would have all been fine. But no, they just don't seem to have the ability to manage anything.
David Masiotra, I want to get your reaction. Are you concerned about the precedent that this set?
Yes, I am concerned about the precedent.
In what way?
Well, one has to wonder, is it a signifying act? Does it send the message, if you kidnap one of ours, we will negotiate an exchange of one of yours for the return of one of ours? That being said, I want to reiterate what our other guests have already expressed, in that there's no amount of joy or pleasure that is too much to express for the homecoming of one of our troops and their families already endure such hard sacrifices, but again, despite the appropriate concerns about that precedent, which I do have, it's difficult to be the one to say that, knowing that one of the troops or members of their family could be listening right now. It's a tough issue.
But again, it seems to me the bigger, broader issue is it's great to have one soldier back. But again, I asked the question in the beginning, what is the price? The return of Bo back to Idaho, does that, because of the trade involved with five people who, notwithstanding what allegedly has been arranged in secret, the public does not know what the deal was with Cutter, but does anybody doubt that these five guys that were released, trained terrorists, are going to be back on the battlefield again?
Well, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, Bruce, that this is going. These five guys are going to be back on the battlefield and in no time soon. But the fact
and
of the
how
matter
many
is,
people have they killed? Well, and how many people might they kill in the future?
That's true, but you know, prison exchanges have happened all throughout history during wartime. So, I mean, it's not as if it's something new. It's not a new concept. But the fact of the matter is, you know, our Americans are worth something, and if it has 5-to-1 ratio, hey, so be it. Prison exchanges happen all the time in Israel. There's not this much bandied about
that's
in the United States.
That's at a time of war where you're dealing with two countries which abide by the Geneva Conventions.
Absolutely.
This is Al-Qaeda. This is the Taliban. These are monsters. This
is not
absent
the same
of
any
kind
plan,
of
how long would you have this individual, you know, under this authority?
I couldn't.
He's already
imagine.
Been there for 5 years. Yes, I mean, what's the plan to get this American out of there?
I understand.
He's been there for 5 years. Are we going to sit there, twiddle our thumbs, and see what actually is going to go on? What's going to transpire over the next few years?
Ron,
we're debating this with the lack of a lot of information, and that what bothers me about this topic and the next ones we get into. Mm-hmm. That there could have been if he was, we heard he was sick. For instance, what if he had died? The Taliban's shit would have been gone. They would have had, yeah. And maybe they were wanting 10 or 20 released for his one, okay? Mm-hmm. So we don't know if the negotiations were in play for the Taliban saying, hey, we want 20 released, and we said we're holding to 5. But then what if he'd have died? Then they had nothing.
But we also have to assume that for the last 5 years, that he's perhaps has been mistreated in some way.
Yes.
There may be health issues the last 5 years. This could be, I mean, I'm going to admit something on the program here this evening that I'm very concerned about. When the administration sends Susan Rice out to explain this deal, I worry, as an American, when I see her on Sunday morning television telling me a story about an important issue, I frankly don't trust her. I think she should have her hand raised and take a solemn oath when she goes on a Sunday show, because she has a history of lying to the American people, or certainly misrepresenting the administration.
And something so recent as Benghazi, especially. I mean, yeah, she's probably the least likely person to put in front of a camera in order to.
Yet
you know,
she was out there today.
Absolutely. I understand what you're saying.
And she talked about what a joyous day it was. Well, it isn't necessarily a joyous day if you are the parent of someone that was killed by one of these five people that has been released, or that you are some parent listening or watching this evening, and maybe your son or daughter will be killed by a terrorist in the future, a terrorist attack planned by one of these five people that were let out. Anyway, those are some of the thoughts. I want to get reaction from everybody listening and watching tonight. 1-800-723-8029. Your reaction to the big trade today. Back shortly. Back in Chicago, Ron Gibbs made a very important point in segment number one. He said, we don't know the complete story now. It's going to take a while before we get the full story, if we ever get the full story. Again, I was lamenting the fact that Susan Rice was the one that was sent out to tell this story to the American people today, and I don't trust her. But a detail here concerns me, and that is, because on one hand, she used the term released, that Bo was released, Bergdahl was released, and the president used the word extraction. Now, to me, those are two different things. David, what do you think? What's your understanding of what do you know and what's been said right now?
Well,
did somebody go in and get this guy and then pull him out? And if that was the case, then why did we have to trade anything?
No, it seems like it was a negotiated release, right. And this is another failure of communication from the Obama administration. One of many failures. I mean, there's been a successive line of failures from this administration, and the incompetence now knows no limits. I mean, they accidentally outed the name of the CIA chief in Afghanistan. It's just every week there's a new story of error, mistake, foolishness.
Anthony, does it make a difference whether it was an extraction or a release?
Yes, absolutely it makes a difference. Because if it was an extraction, that means the military was involved.
Right.
And if the military was involved, then I see Congress's point to where, hey, listen, what happened, when it happened, why it happened, who knew what happened and when they say it happened.
Well, one of the stories that, again, that's come out thus far is that one of those that went in and got him out, I guess there was some communication between Bo and that person, and he wrote SP with a question mark as to whether or not this guy, or SF, was this person special forces, and he nodded yes. And there's also a report, again, allegedly said by his father, that Bo doesn't speak English or doesn't understand English anymore. Now, how does the father know that if the father hasn't had any extended conversation with him?
Yeah, I heard that the father speaks, is it Afghan, I guess,
yes,
is the English language they use, and because he was in contact with the captors so many times over the years. But David's got it right. I mean, this is a problem of competence. One after another after another. And you don't, in an extraction, it seems to me you don't give up five.
Well, again,
Susan Rice also said today when she was being, this was Candy Crowley, was trying to pin her down on a moment by moment of what happened, is she said that Bo had already been released to American forces before the release of the detainees, the Taliban terrorists, and in that period of time after they were released, then members of Congress were informed. So there was a period of time when members of Congress who either could have or by law should have been informed. But the way she answered that question, she really was couching it. And my other question, insofar as stage managing, since this administration is a master of stage managing, the parents were already there at the White House when the announcement was made. Mm-hmm. They were in the Rose Garden. And I got to tell you, there's no direct flight from Boise, Idaho to Washington, D.C. And they're a long way from Boise. So seems to me that they're planning the story, the spin, before taking into consideration what they should have done legally. Ron, this is a little fishy, too?
Oh, totally. And I think after the Susan Rice thing, if you caught it, Chuck Hagel then was interviewed on some Air Force flight talking about it and trying to clarify it. And what was said was that he walked freely into the hands of a couple of a dozen special forces troops waiting for him as he crossed over, let's say, the border. They were waiting for him there to be, then flown away. And he was on a helicopter when they were trying to communicate with him. It was so loud, and they had to write down, are you SF? Yeah. And he said, yes. He wrote down because they couldn't hear.
So if he walked across, then that was a release.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. But Hagel made, this is the key point, we're dealing with a vacuum here, and Hagel said on Air Force One or whatever he was on that there was a state of urgency in this decision, which we don't know yet, and that's what's got to come out further as to why. Was he ill? Was there some linchpin here to where this exchange had to happen quickly, or it wasn't going to happen at all? We don't know that.
But there was an urgency in getting Gutter involved. Obviously, this has been going on for weeks, if not longer. Yeah. And if you know by law that the Congress has to be involved, why would he not bring them to the White House and say, this is what's going to happen, let's try to make it go of it? And that's the incompetence I see.
No, I disagree. I disagree. So it's called leader.
And also everybody says, obviously it's secret. What was the secret deal? How do we know that when these guys go to Qatar, they're really going to be secure in some way? I mean, one thing we know about Gitmo, they were secure there. People don't like Gitmo, but they weren't getting away from Gitmo. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure who can guarantee that they're going to be there for 1 year, allegedly? That's part of the deal we allegedly know. Who's going to watch over these guys?
There seems to be a pattern of, I don't even know if it's incompetence, it might qualify as arrogance and authoritarian behavior from the Obama administration in their circumvention and exclusion of Congress mm-hmm. on a variety of yeah. matters. How many alterations have they made to affordable care without consulting Congress? This is the latest example. And it's another example that illustrates the double standard, not only visible in the Democratic Party, but also the mainstream media. President Bush signed several executive statements amending congressional legislation, and I oppose those, but it was treated generally as the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Whereas all of President Obama's circumvention and exclusion of the legislative branch of government goes by with silence.
It's brilliance.
I disagree with you because Obama's between a rock and a hard place, and I agree with you, and maybe I disagree with his tactics, but if he'd have gone to the Republicans to negotiate some, they would have said not only no, but hell no, and tell us more. The word compromise is a pox.
And therein lies the problem that I have, too. I mean, you have to take a look at who you deal with in terms of the opposing party here. Nothing Obama can do or say the Republicans will agree with. And so, like everything else, the devil's in the details. Mm. And it's easy to Monday morning quarterback when there's an issue of such importance. But I think once the final word gets out there and the Americans are told exactly what went down and how it went down, I think that'll bring more comfort to those
involved.
Question
to our military people, and then we're going to go to calls, okay? When I was trained in the military, National Guard, okay, during the 60s, basic training, if you're taken captive, name, rank, and serial number. That's all you give. Drilled into you, name, rank, and serial number. Now, he gave more under duress, mm-hmm. but he gave more than name, rank, and serial number. And so did some others, including John McCain. Mm-hmm. They were used for, not willingly, but, you know, who can say that when everything is being, when you're being tortured,
No one knows the tactics that were used over the past 5 years in order to extract information out of this individual. So, in theory, it sounds cute, but in the end, I mean, somebody has to be held accountable. And, you know, these guys aren't the nicest guys in the world over there on that part of the world.
Does learning the language, does any of this cause you some concern? Does the basic fact of why he walked off the base concern you? Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm concerned with the lack of details at this point, Bruce. And, you know, once the details come out, maybe that will put me to rest over certain issues. But, again, you can't keep second-guessing this president at this level because once this whole thing gets into the realm of politics, who knows what's happening? At that point, the Republicans will want to disagree with him on any level.
But facts don't
whatever.
Lie.
Yeah.
Facts don't lie.
Well, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but everybody's not entitled to their own set of facts. That's true.
No, but we should know, the American people should know. I mean, it's good that he's back, okay?
Right.
For his parents, for those loved ones that he has, it's good for him. And right. all the nature of my discussion this evening and is, as a parent, I know how joyful those parents are. But the joy of one family and one troop, how do you measure that against the potential precedent that's being set and the danger that may lie ahead? That's my concern.
And that danger could be for, in a sense, civilian workers that are over there because they could take them hostage.
That's always been a part of war, though. I mean, there's nothing to say.
When you're dealing with countries at war,
but they never
got
traded.
Right, right.
But it's never a 5-to-1
trade. But being kidnapped has always been a part of the game.
Still,
I mean, there's no rules in war. I don't know why.
Oh, there are rules in war.
Well, there are rules in the Geneva Convention. We follow the Geneva Convention.
But they don't. That's my
point. But they don't. That's the problem.
Susan Rice said.
There's always been rules in our part.
Susan Rice said today, he said, well, you know, we're winding down the war in Afghanistan. That's not quite right. We are winding down our participation in that mm-hmm. war. The war is going to go on. Mm-hmm. There's another war that's going on. That's the war against us by the terrorists. Mm-hmm. And we've put
still
five
fighting.
Leaders back on the battlefield in the war against us. And I will tell you, the longest war in the history of this country is the war against us. It's going to surpass the Civil War. Yeah. It's going to surpass Afghanistan. It's going to surpass all these other wars. And this decision... Again, releasing one American troop, and I'm glad he's alive, and I'm glad he's coming home to his parents, but releasing him is putting five more really bad guys into the war, and they, even if they're out of out of commission for 1 year in Qatar, they're going to be back on the battlefield. They're going to be directing activities out to kill the United States and Americans, hurt the United States and kill Americans for the rest of their lives. And that's what we gave back to the enemy with this decision today.
Yeah, and if you look at Qatar, there's been some split between the members of the Gulf Corporation Cooperation Council. I do my research in the Middle East. And Saudi and Bahrain and so forth are having troubles with Qatar because Qatar is somewhat becoming friends with these radical elements of radical Islam. And so there's actually a split even within the Gulf that makes you think, is this the country to
the Taliban leader also thanked the leader of Qatar for making it happen. 1-800-723-8229. We do have callers. We'll hear from them when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let us introduce our guests now or have them introduce themselves. Ron Gibbs, tell us who you are.
I'm currently an adjunct professor at the University of Chicago, Harris School of Public Policy, political analyst, public policy consultant, and Vietnam veteran. I've been very active in veterans affairs in Washington, D.C. with the Wall and with the Veterans Art Museum here in Chicago.
Anthony Anderson.
I'm chairman of Republican Precinct Project, this statewide organization dedicated to filling every precinct in each county with Republicans that can be filled, actually.
And also a veteran.
Veteran. United States Marine Corps. Hoorah.
Hoorah. Go Army.
David.
I'm a political columnist with the Indianapolis Star, and I write for the book section of the Daily Beast. I also contribute to The Federalist and Splice Today, and I'm the author of a forthcoming book from the University of Kentucky Press called All That We Learned About Living, The Art and Legacy of John Mellencamp.
And Mike Miller, and I'm an associate professor of economics at DePaul. And since we were on last with you, Bruce, I was appointed associate dean as well. So I'm now also a paper pusher.
Oh, my God.
But I know that administration sometimes gets a bad rap, but there are lots of important things that administrators have to do to make sure that the mission of teaching and learning gets done. And that's what
Any paper cuts.
I won't get any paper cuts. I do push a lot of paper.
That's good. Quick note, for those who know, the Museum of Broadcast Communications is where we do this show from every single Sunday night. We've got our major benefit of the year. It's coming up on Saturday night, June 21st. It will be a salute to Dick Cavett, one of the great television icons of all time. It's $125. It supports the nonprofit activities of the Museum of Broadcast Communications. You can go to our website, museum.tv, and get your tickets. And again, I had a wonderful conversation earlier this week with Dick Cavett. He was recalling his early days. He used to come to Chicago virtually every summer to visit his uncle Paul, who lived up in Evanston. He was raised in Nebraska. So he's coming home to his second home, and that's Chicago on the 21st of June. Hope you come and meet this television icon. It's then going to be a three-month retrospective on all his great shows, all of his great interviews, because really when he was on in the 1970s, before Nightline, for some of our younger viewers and listeners out there, before Nightline, much of the 1970s political life in America and late 60s, it unfolded on the Dick Cavett Show, not only with popular culture issues, but iconic literary figures, as well as the entire Watergate scandal. It all unfolded on the Dick Cavett Show. Those programs will be playing here for 3 months. But again, if you want to meet Dick Cavett in person, it's the 21st of June. Let's go to Fred, listening to us in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on WoWo. Go ahead. Nice to hear from Fort Wayne tonight.
Regarding Mrs. Rice, she is so radioactive by now. I would think the president would have to wear a hazmat suit when he's talking to her. And they sent her out there yet again. She was supposed to have all the brains in the world to be the UN ambassador, etc. Now she can't even be called before Congress. Well, those cohorts of hers have to realize that once Mr. Obama is gone from office, he's not going to be padding their bank accounts with millions and millions of dollars until they kick off at 92 or whatever, and considering there's a national debt and unfunded liabilities that come to almost $100 trillion, which means every man, woman, and kid in the U.S. is in the hole for $1.25 million, it's going to take a lot of dough if this thing progresses to its natural And
let me focus on what our topic is tonight and ask you. You made your comments about Susan Rice, but my question to you is, are you happy that Bo Bergdahl is home? Are you not?
That's fine with me. He is an American. What possessed him to walk off a fire base without a weapon makes you wonder just how cogent and with it he was at the time. Unless he had some unknown or whatever was half radicalized when he was over there and nobody found out about it. But the guy managed to survive for 5 years. Nobody ever found him. And he's in relatively good health from the pictures I've seen on TV. They were saving him for something. And the guys that they exchanged for him, if those guys don't look like the devil's archangels, I don't know who does. Right. Just take a look at some of those mugs.
I know. It's a scary group. Ron Gibbs, you wanted to comment earlier about Susan Rice and also about some of the issues that Fred brought up.
Well, I just think the issue, again, we're dealing with so many unknowns here. And as Secretary Hagel said, after Susan Rice, there are circumstances that we don't know about that, as he used the word, urgency. And if it was a health issue and had he died and we did nothing to get him out of there, I think public opinion would be changed a little bit. I'm totally in agreement. These terrorists should, we don't deal with terrorists, and that should be the firm line. This should almost be looked at as a one-off. We wanted to save this person's life is the way I'm interpreting it. And if that is the case, we did the right thing in bringing him home, and we need to continue to fight on. And there are many more terrorists than these five dudes that we released. So there are a lot of people out there still after us, and we've got to be vigilant.
Speaking of that, I want to kind of switch gears and talk about one of the other big stories. In fact, it would have been our lead story had Bo Bergdahl not been released. And that was the interview this week by Brian Williams on NBC of Edward Snowden. And it was a much anticipated interview. It was an NBC News exclusive. There was actually 4 hours of interview with him. Only 1 hour ended up on television. And David Masiotra, I know you've watched it all, and as did virtually everybody around the table this evening. What did you think of Edward Snowden before the show, and did your opinion change at all after watching it?
My opinion remained the same. Before the show, I saw Edward Snowden as an intelligent, passionate, and patriotic man who did a service to this country in the tradition of Daniel Ellsberg and some of the great whistleblowers. And after the show, I felt even more firmly grounded in that belief. The oath that every military member, we have two veterans here with us tonight, takes is to protect the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the Constitution was in violation with these policies. A federal judge has determined that. And Edward Snowden attempted, according to his own testimony and according to information gained by mainstream news outlets, attempted to go up the chain and do things in the proper way. He was rejected, denied, so he took this seemingly extreme act but informed Americans of something very nefarious and dangerous that the government is doing, and we should be thankful.
Mike Miller, your reaction.
Boy, I can't believe we're on the opposite sides. I agree with you completely. I didn't follow Snowden that closely. But what I did hear was he didn't even finish high school. He's this doper. Mm-hmm. The articulation, the grammar, the presentation, either he is Olivier and he is the greatest actor of all time, or there is really something in that noggin of his that he can present with almost no pause exactly.
Clarity.
His vocabulary. And right. The way he uses words like freedom and liberty properly, I was just blown away by it. And I have this problem I have that he's treasonous, giving up secrets. Mm-hmm. Who was he to do this? But at the same time, he tried to go through the normal channels, just like you said. Mm-hmm. And this is what we want. We want people. We don't want another place where I was just doing what I was told, like what happened in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. You want to, if we're violating the Constitution and the fact that everything that's come out of the NSA, and we now found out on the way driving down to the show tonight that they are keeping all these these pictures that we send on emails and so forth for facial recognition. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of crap that we're now talking about because he got it out there.
Exactly.
By the way, Glenn Greenwald, the reporter who really broke this story, he has said that the stories that are still out there, are sitting in newsrooms are even bigger. And I think the story that you just alluded to about the facial recognition could be one of these. It's the next big bombshell we're dealing with. I want to go to Ron Gibbs. You saw the interview, if not all of it. You saw a lot of it. Your reaction to it.
Gosh, there's several things. But first thing that struck me, and I had not seen him interviewed at all. So first thing that struck me was when he did enlist in the military. And he was going to Special Forces. And he used the term, and I was in officer candidate school, and he used the term washed out. And if anything, when you're in the military, to say that is very demeaning.
Condescending.
That's a disgrace to be washed out.
Absolutely.
And so I felt he was some.
What does it mean? Does it mean not good enough?
Yeah, basically, you couldn't cut it, and you either recycled. When I was in officer candidate school, fifth month, I had a couple of shots of cortisone in my kneecaps because I didn't want to go back and start all over again. So psychologically, that's number one. There's something going on there, and moving forward. So he gets out of there and then joins the NSA and CIA and he talks about the Patriot Act. 2001, the Patriot Act comes out. He cites that in one of his essays, that it exceeded the bounds of the invasion of our privacy. And when you go back and read the accounts of the Patriots Act in 2001, that is unheard of. The bill passed in 2 days. It passed in the House, and the next day it passed in the Senate, 89-1. And who read that behemoth document? And they called for, eavesdropping, invasion of our email messages. That was the authority.
It would have been un-American to vote against it.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, yes.
Senator Feingold was called unpatriotic and un-American as the one Senate vote. That was unfair. And now half of the provisions of that Patriot Act have been rescinded, and that is what Snowden has cited for, he's saying, is the egregious road that NSA has been taking.
Anthony Anderson, you saw the interview, your reaction.
On the one hand,
did your opinion change?
I wanted to see the facts as I wanted to hear his word. I wanted to hear his side of the story. And again, if you listen to his side of the story, it was a cogent argument. I mean, he was answering all the questions the way one would expect a person with knowledge and understanding of the NSA processes to answer.
But I've got to stop you. We're about to go to a break. We're going to come back to you. We're going to a break.
Okay.
That happens frequently when you're talking on this show. 1-800-723-8029. What did you think of the Snowden interview? Give us a buzz. Bruce Dumont, thank you very much for being with us. Anthony Anderson, I interrupted you because the commercials did when you were talking about Edward Snowden and your reaction and whether it changed before or after the interview.
Well, I have a concern. And one of the concerns is this, Bruce. I mean, when I was 17 years old, I took an oath of office, in the military at least, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign or domestic. And I'm sure at some point in his life, he took that same oath. Now, one has to look at what he did in terms of, a larger perspective. Did he, to an extent, put this country at great risk or great harm against its enemies by releasing this information?
What's your answer to that question in your view?
In my view, I can't say for certain that he did, to the extent that the media has portrayed him as releasing all this information, because they're saying that he released military documentation.
Nobody has been able to give specifics.
And then
it's guilt by association or smear by association.
And when you ask for specifics,
there are none.
Right. And when you look at Mr. Snowden, what he said in terms of, he's asked Congress to subpoena this information from the NSA, and, where's Congress at on this issue? Have they subpoenaed whether or not, did he try to run this stuff up the chain or not? And if so, then, has anybody acted on it? And at this point, we don't know those questions. Those questions need to be answered.
By the way, I found it interesting that John Kerry was on the Today Show, and this is what he had to say. If Mr. Snowden wants to come back to the United States today, we'll have him on a flight today. We'd be delighted for him to come back. And he should come back. And that's what a patriot would do. A patriot would not run away and look for refuge in Russia or Cuba or some other country. A patriot would stand up in the United States and make his case to the American people. Now, let's see. John Kerry said that. Was John Kerry describing himself because he stood up against the Vietnam War? I mean, is he setting himself up as a hero? There's controversy about whether or not he is a hero or a traitor as well. Mm-hmm. He's now the Secretary of State, and he has been probably the most vociferous public official in denouncing Edward Snowden, next to Mike Rogers and the intelligence community and Dianne Feinstein. I mean, would he get a fair trial if he ever came back here?
Absolutely not. I mean,
does anybody think
it's just not the case?
Of course not.
Not in these whistleblower cases like that, because if that were the case, you know, something would have been done prior to him releasing this information. That's just a fact.
You know, the other point that I thought came out, and I knew this. The point is, he has released a significant amount of information. He gave them to news organizations, and he put the onus on news organizations to make the judgment call as to what needed to be released and when it needed to be released. I mean, this the latest shoe to fall, the New York Times story about the facial recognition.
Right.
I mean, Edward Snowden's been a story in this country for over a year now. It's over a year now since that piece came out. And again, there is some military information that's in there, which he said that it was never his intention to harm any military operation at all.
You know, there's
so the question I have is what did he go after for the information? That's what, to me, is the fog. We don't know what he was tracking. I thought it was revealing that he said that he didn't reveal any information that would harm any individual.
Right.
You know, putting them in harm's way. So what information did he get? And then where is that validated? Because nothing has come forward.
Well, there was a source the other day leaked out that Snowden was working with the Russians since 2007. But, you know, I haven't seen anything else since then.
Well, that's a leaked report. That came from Mike Rogers, who said that on Meet the Press he thought that he was working for the Russians. There has been no evidence, and he's been pressed on that. And I like Congressman Rogers a great deal. But there's been no specificity on that charge at all?
Well, there's no specificity, because over the past 10 years, two different parties in government control, two different administrations, there's been a mendacious and malicious abuse of power and misuse of authoritative informational directive. And just think about it. Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, Saddam Hussein's connection to al-Qaeda, the killing of Pat Tillman, the rescue of Jessica Lynch. If you like your health care plan, you can keep it. Benghazi, on and on and on. We can keep going. I have a simple rule. I believe nothing the government tells me without hard evidence, just like I would believe nothing my spouse told me if she told me 8, 9 major lies in as many years. So Edward Snowden is exposing an encroachment on the Fourth Amendment here. And to provide a cover story for that encroachment, you're seeing the government, John Kerry, Barack Obama, and all of their minions.
All sides.
Yes.
All sides.
Yes. Smear him without specificity, as you identify. And that's because they don't have specificity. They're attempting to distract the American people from this exposing of a program that was never publicly identified, never debated, and likely violates the Constitution.
I think one of the strongest points that he made in that interview was that based on the revelations that he was responsible for, the President of the United States has called for reforms. A judge has said that programs are unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Congress is responding as well. So he did get the attention. He got the attention of three branches of service. And again, that would have never happened had he not done what he's doing. And even today, as even though young people tend not to be too concerned, they still see him as a hero. They're not as concerned as an older generation about the infringement on their personal liberties and on their privacy, because they are part of an age where they tweet and fax and or not fax, but Facebook whatever they want. So they don't really care. And I want to talk more about that. We're out of time for hour number one. We'll all be back for hour number two, unless you're watching this on television. Then you won't. You can only imagine what we're going to be talking about in the next hour. If you're listening to us on radio, you'll get the full. We'll be in your ear for another hour, but we're going to pause for network news. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away. Back from Chicago shortly.
ladies and gentlemen, Dick Cavett.
He's one of the greatest television interviewers of all time. The legendary Dick Cavett is coming to Chicago.
There's a certain excitement in the air.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications presents a salute to Dick Cavett, Saturday, June 21st at 6:30.
But this is me. I'm letting it all hang out.
Spend an evening with a television legend.
Why don't we see how the show is?
A salute to Dick Cavett. Go to museum.tv for your tickets now.
Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Marine Corps veteran Anthony Anderson, Ron Gibbs, Vietnam veteran from the University of Chicago, David Masiotra, columnist for the Indianapolis Star, and Mike Miller from DePaul University. Our program tonight, coming to you from my own base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And also, if you want to tweet us a question, our new name is at Dumo. At D-U-M-O. Make it real short. Four letters. At Dumo. If you want to tweet us a response or comments concerning the broadcast. In this segment of our program, we're going to let each of our guests sort of determine the subjects that they want to talk about. We do this periodically, and we usually get into some pretty good discussions. And we're going to begin with Mike Miller from DePaul University.
And what I want to talk about is the issue that Snowden's interview sometime back, what it brought up in terms of an issue where it's not black and white, it's not perfectly clear. And I've been so torn when this whole thing first came out, I thought the guy was a patriot. And then I heard people argue, no, he's a traitor. And when I listened to their arguments, I began to think, maybe he in fact is a traitor. But it isn't clear, after the interview and so forth, whether he's a traitor or a parrot. I'm coming down on the side of patriot, that in fact he had to be a whistleblower. He did everything he was supposed to try to tell people what was going on. It was against the Constitution and so forth, which I think is true. And they simply told him not to do this and pushed him away. And he had to do what he did to get people's attention.
Is one of the reasons why the establishment, whether it's John Kerry or Mike Rogers, that one of the reasons, including the President of the United States, why everyone is piling on Edward Snowden is they don't want to encourage another Edward Snowden.
Excuse me. Yeah, that could be the case.
What do you think, David? Do you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. And typically, centralized power, wherever it takes place, is very protective of its own interests. They have kind of a mafia-like mentality. They want to punish those who violate the code. And one thing that I would caution in reference to the Edward Snowden stories, you often hear people say, well, what do you have to hide or what do you have to fear if you're not a criminal or a terrorist? Right. Not too long ago, it's not ancient history, the Nixon administration under a program called COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Program, tapped people's phones, monitored their activities, and if they were identified as political opponents of the Nixon administration, the administration used the information they gained through the FBI, a misuse of the FBI, to get them fired from their jobs, get them in trouble in their marriages, et cetera, so on and so forth. Well, with this apparatus, this data mining and the access to our phone records and emails, do you really want to empower the government to destroy citizens' lives? Because it can be done. It's already happened.
Well, in addition to that COINTELPRO program that Nixon had put in place, I mean, they were actually monitoring civil rights leaders at the time also. Mm-hmm. That was the primary reason for having that program into place in the first
place.
They
wanted Martin Luther King to kill himself.
Yes,
that was one of the goals of the program. They wanted to spread information, derogatory information. They wanted him to commit suicide, mm-hmm. and so
it was a way to subvert the civil rights movement.
If we know that this is going on, and again, a lot of this information has been going on for a long, long time. How does it change? How does Edward Snowden's warnings and the most recent things about now the visual, you know, the facial recognition, the fact that that Skype activity can be recorded, and again, this goes back to the very first thing that Edward Snowden said in the very first interview. This is over a year ago. A little story. It wasn't the big part of the story, but he said the goal of the NSA is to understand the behavioral activities of Americans. Mm-hmm. Behavioral activities is where you shop, what websites you go to. It is the absolute 100% invasion of privacy that, as you say, if used, can absolutely destroy lives. I want to get Ron's response, and then I want to go back to you.
Well, 2 points. One, that data mining. Let's go to what happens with Karl Rove and Democrats doing demographics on voters, the same thing as you're talking about. Karl Rove tells a story where he got Governor Bush elected by knowing five things about everybody at this table, that you're a fisherman, that you're a hunter, that you read this, you do that, and then they go after you in public opinion to get your vote. Now it's 25 things they know about everybody at this table. It's the same thing that NSA is doing. They're gathering data the same way in campaigns as they are there. That's one point. But the other issue is this: the issue that
and so does Google.
So does Google. Yeah.
So does Amazon.
But Google can't take my freedom.
Yeah. Right. But the issue here.
Share it.
Yeah, we're putting the blame on Snowden here when Congress and the Bush administration and even Obama did not put proper oversight after the Patriots Act. And let's go back to, again, as I said, in 2001, this behemoth bill passed in 2 days, and then some of the provisions sunsetted. Now, where the heck was Congress to provide oversight to all these egregious things we're talking about? And here comes a guy, Snowden, who's buried in to the bowels of the NSA saying, you know what? It's not changing.
But here's the point I want to make, too, also. Was his act illegal, one, and he needs to be held accountable, too? Now, the information that he's gathered and he's given to us, we're grateful
for. It was illegal.
So under this circumstances, then he needs to be held accountable. To what extent? That's between him, the officials of this country, and anybody else that's concerned. But the fact of the matter is, no one man is larger than the laws of this country. And Edward Snowden, he has to be held to some sort of accountability.
Does everybody agree with that? Does everybody agree with that?
Well, I would say
you said recently that he gets punished but no free pass. You said everybody agreed that no one believed that he would get a fair trial if he came back to the United States. So he's basically saying, do I go back to the United States knowing that I will probably spend the rest of my life in prison? They won't kill me, but I could spend the rest of my life in prison. I could be killed in prison.
I wonder if he'd get a fair trial in the fact that if I were on the jury, I might nullify the law. I might vote for him in spite of what you put before me because I think what they were doing was so egregious.
So let that process play out.
But we should.
That's all I'm saying. Just let the process play out.
We should spend less time discussing the proper, appropriate punishment for Edward Snowden, and we should spend more time discussing the proper, appropriate punishment for the government officials
who implemented this program and lied about it.
Remember, President Obama said this program didn't exist.
National security has to take precedence. This country was here way before any of us, and it'll be here way past any of us. It's not up to one man to decide whether or not the fate of a nation. That's what the president is for.
No, but national security and the blanket of national security has been used by politicians, left and right, Republicans and Democrats, to hide things from the American people that they deserve to know.
And this country,
the Constitution, you have to bleed red, white, and blue. Or else it won't work.
And this country is here because of the Constitution. And you laid down your life to defend it. And there's no asterisk that says, unless we're scared. What's in the Constitution needs to be protected, whether we're scared or not.
Period.
Yeah.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, it's going to be Ron Gibbs' turn. And he's going to pick the subject for the next 15 minutes. But give us a buzz. On back. Thanks very much for being with us. Ron Gibbs, by the way, in case you've just tuned into the program, this is something we do periodically. We let each of our guests select one particular subject that they would like to discuss, and it can be on any topic. And we introduced a new rule to the game a couple of weeks ago, and that is if the next person up wants to continue the discussion that someone else started, they have the right to do that. So you now, Ron Gibbs, have the floor. What issue do you want to talk about?
Well, I'll start out with a quote that I'll challenge the viewers and the panelists to tell me who said this quote, which leads into a very important issue in the news. And the quote goes this: the willingness with which our young people are likely to serve in any war, comma, no matter how justified, shall be directly proportional to how they perceive veterans of earlier wars were treated and appreciated by our nation. And who
Barack
do you think?
Obama?
Can I guess?
Yes.
George Washington.
Very good. George Washington, our first president, said how we treat our veterans coming home will be predicated on our ability to raise armies in the future, which leads me to the topic, of course, what happened to the VA and Secretary Shinseki. I've had the honor of being at his swearing in, and I think he's a true hero, patriot, loved by the troops, and took a hit here. Tried to do a lot for VA for veterans. The budget, ironically, from 2009 to 14 doubled from $79 billion to over $150 billion. The VA now has 280,000 people nationwide. 6.2 million veterans are served. What we have here is a systemic problem of an organization that has grown exponentially in the last few years. They've done a lot for homelessness, but they have dropped the ball and failed in confidence to the troops and to the American people with this backlog of people being treated properly and honoring our veterans coming home, and that's egregious.
Ron, isn't a simple answer to this issue, maybe it isn't a simple answer, but it's an immediate answer, and we discussed it last week on this program. If you're a veteran, you have a card. You walk into any hospital and you get whatever service you want.
No, you don't.
No,
you
don't. That's the way I'm saying. Should it be
that way? No,
it be that way? And why do we have to have a Veterans Affairs just to deal with that? We don't have if you've experienced, let's say, the VA VA financing of your house, or the VA the VA program for education. There's not a VA university. You have your voucher, and you walk in, and you use it as part of your rights. Has the bureaucracy of the VA outlived its, obviously, efficiency? Wouldn't that be a simpler way of doing it?
Totally, and I think it's a bureaucratic issue, and it's a money issue. They have downsized the number of facilities. I mean, as far as VA hospitals, some places people have to drive 50, 60, 100 miles to get to a VA facility to get treatment. And that's not quick access. They closed in Chicago, the downtown facility, lakefront, and so forth. So
one reason I guessed Barack Obama is because he attacked George Bush while Bush was president over the VA issue, and I thought that was a lead into where he was going to attack Bush. And one thing that aggravates me about this whole situation at the VA, that the president had the nerve to say he only found out on the radio or from the media that this problem. He 5 years ago made this one of his key ideas, and he's been asleep at the switch the entire time.
He learns a lot
years.
From the media.
Yes, that's scary.
Now that we know that this president has long learned about this fraudulent behavior, what is he going to do to those individuals is he going to ask for forfeiture of those bonuses that those individuals received based on this information that we now know it was fraudulent?
He said he wants to go after them. I mean, the question is, going after the people that actually did the were responsible for it is one thing. It's frankly easy to get rid of the head of the VIA. VA. It's a little more difficult.
Bruce,
but the Justice Department can do that. David,
to your question about, in an ideal world, allowing veterans access to private hospitals with some kind of veterans card, I would ask, is there anyone who reacts with anything but fright when they receive a letter from the government? Is there anyone who pays their taxes on April 15th with excitement? Is there anyone who visits a government office with glee and eagerness? The superiority of the private sector to the public sector is a long proven established fact in American life. And I have a source inside the VA, someone who works with the VA in Washington, D.C., and I won't reveal his name. I won't pull an Edward Snowden. I'll protect his anonymity. But he identifies so much waste of time, energy, and money in the Veterans Department, and that you can make that point about every department of government.
You can.
Most governmental programs exist to employ governmental program workers. And that's why
they're not necessarily competent or efficient people.
That's why they're always expanding. That's why in the wake of this scandal, despite what Ron said about the doubling of the VA budget, there's Democrats calling for more funding for the VA. It's absurd, and your question, I would hope, would receive an answer from Congress or the president, but I won't hold my breath.
No, I mean, it seems like a logical thing. Anthony, you were making a point?
Well, the point was, insofar as the bonuses were concerned, my point was, you know, now that we know that they've been padding numbers over the years, and for how long, who knows, will someone other than General Shinseki be held accountable?
Do you think that, based on your quote from General Washington, do you believe that future generations are going to think twice about serving their country because of the actions of what transpired in Phoenix and other facilities?
But for the most part, I don't see there's a lot of people, especially younger people, willing and ready to go into the military like the, you know, people of yesteryear. It's just not in the cards. I mean, it's just not there. I don't see it.
But we hear that the soldier of today is a higher quality of soldier. Is that not true, Ron?
They're a higher quality soldier. I mean, training is much more technological. But I think long term, I think the problem with people going in Iraq, we have a smaller force. And when people do three or four tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, that should not happen. Where we're playing with fire with post-traumatic syndrome for people doing that many tours. And as a result, if we don't have enough troops because of the volunteer army, in my opinion, and if anything, the draft should be imposed again for some type of service, if not the military, toward Peace Corps or something for our country. But I think,
you think that's a good idea, David? Should there be a 2-year period when young people serve their nation in some way?
No, not at all. I think that's a terrible idea, with all due respect. I don't want the government to be able to misuse that power as well, as it happened in Vietnam and as it happened elsewhere. You know, Milton Friedman, the great libertarian economist, was the one who advised President Nixon to end the draft. If we live in a free society, we should give young people the freedom of dictating their own life, making their own choices. And look, we've all at some point, just in this conversation, expressed a criticism of the Iraq War. How many more people would have been killed, maimed, psychologically traumatized in that Iraq war had there been a draft? I think that's a bad idea.
Well, but that's a different situation. After 9/11, this country would have done anything on the tip of a dime if the president said so. That's why the Patriots Act passed in one day, which was ridiculous. Right. Nobody read the bill, and we go into harm's way on a crisis mode. And not calling for service to our country, I think, is unpatriotic in a part. We need to have people love this country and do something for – what have you done for our country lately? And people, you know, don't – that's wrong. I think there needs to be service to country in some way. It doesn't have to be military. It could be VISTA, helping people in your community, hungry people, poor people. Give back to this great country to make it stronger.
Well, what I will second you on is that we live in a country with an awful lot of disgusting sentimentality and sloganeering, support the troops, yellow ribbons. But as we've seen in this latest scandal, and as you can study with looking at the treatment the veterans received coming home from Vietnam, we don't back our words with action. We've successfully let our veterans down, and that's a national tragedy and shame.
Service to country should not come at the expense of other people's lives.
Mike, what do you think?
I wonder if we had managers who were in the head of some of these departments who were from the real world of business, for example, would these things happen? Because it appears that Shinseki was lied to. People told him everything was fine, and he was unwilling to drill down and find out if, in fact, this was true. I just can't believe that a well-trained manager in the private sector would let that happen.
Well, this problem we're talking about, we're focusing on the federal level, but we have a huge systemic problem, federal, state, and local government. Every state government now has deficits, pension reform morass.
Oh, absolutely.
City governments, you know, are going bankrupt because of inefficiencies and corruption. We've had two governors in Illinois go to jail in recent years, three of the last four. Aldermen going to jail, Detroit going bankrupt.
These inefficiencies are constantly the public is made aware of these inefficiencies by investigative journalists, whether it's 60 Minutes, whether it's local newscasts, whether people having daily experiences with the VA or the post office, whatever the case may be. I just had a horrible experience with the post office. Talk about incompetent organization. Absolutely ridiculous. But the reality is the people know about it, but the politicians don't seem to respond with the type of gusto they need to respond to change things. We've talked about this is the second week in the row we've talked about an idea where a veteran that can walk in and get their medical care anywhere. That should be moving forward. That's a good idea.
If you want to reduce the corruption in government, reduce the resources and personnel available for corruption, which means shrink the government, the problem is that...
Or have a higher level of getting in. We've got to pause for a break. We're running out of time with you now. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us. Let me quickly introduce our guest. Ron Gibbs is here. He is a Vietnam veteran, former U.S. Army captain, and also he's a bit shy, but Ron Gibbs is one of those Americans who worked on the idea and the concept of the Vietnam War Memorial. And had it not been for Ron and several of people who had that same passion that you did, that wall would not exist. So I think everyone at this table and everybody listening owes you a debt of great gratitude for the personal efforts that you've put into that. Anthony Anderson also joins us. He's with the Republican Precinct Organization of Chicago. No, that's not right. Republican
Precinct Project.
Project. And also he's in the criminal justice field, working with juvenile justice, and also a United States Marine Corps veteran, Desert Storm and Desert Shield. David Masiotra also joins us. He is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star, a contributor to the Daily Beast. He's doing a new book on John Cougar Mellencamp. And also the ever-popular Mike Miller joins us. He is now an associate dean and an economics professor at DePaul University for 30-plus years. Okay. Yep. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Bill listening to us on WLS Radio. You're on the air.
Yeah, 30 years ago, a friend of mine who was a World War II veteran died of the VA system. He said, there are four hospitals running, one out in Westchester, one near the medical center, and two others, and then one or two at a distance. He said, don't send me to X because, you know, he's got problems with his legs. They don't know how to do it. They won't do it, and he'll die there. Well, his family, he got transferred within the system. He went, he died. The system can't be changed. It's a government bureaucracy that's trying to dispense what is good if it's private medical care or what many physicians attempt to and do achieve, but it's against the system. The system is a government bureaucracy. You can't run private medical care the way you run the post office, and you wind up with results like the post office or the wrong results, you know, foobar and snafu in the military. It just can't be done. You can't have nice guys, really good guys, really capable businessmen run something that is impossible to correct. It's a government bureaucracy, and you can't run it by business rules. Well, business rules make sense if you're running a business. You have no choice. You have no freedom in the VA.
Well, that's
you follow the rules.
Does anybody at this table believe there's any political will to have a massive reform of the VA or the abolishment of the VA, like I suggested at the beginning, you know, in the last segment? That literally you get a card, you should be a veteran who serves their country, they should be able to walk into any hospital, any doctor, and get service. Is that ever going to happen? Is that too radical an idea?
That's way too radical. I don't think the will exists to reform the VA in a sense to where you think it's going to. It's just the system, there's no system in place to replace the VA at this point.
Well, the system is hospitals.
Well, the system is hospitals. But then again, we're going to we don't know whether or not we're going to be in a single payer a few years from now.
It is interesting that Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman, a couple years ago when Obamacare came online, said this it can be just like the VA because the VA is so unbelievably competent. And many on the left were touting that the VA is proof that, in a sense, I don't want to use – I'm going to use the term, but I shouldn't – socialized medicine can truly work. And I'm going to see – look at his blog or whatever and see
Bruce,
what he's saying
I said,
now.
Go ahead, David.
The problem is something called demosclerosis. A writer named Jonathan Rauch calls demosclerosis. It's he likens it to a virus that overtakes the body politic. Once you start a government program, once you give people a subsidy, there's no eliminating it because all of the people employed in that bureaucracy, all of the politicians who benefit from it will continue not only to argue for its maintenance but its expansion. And then once someone like you, a level-headed thinker, comes along and says, you know, wouldn't it be better if we just gave a card and said go to a private hospital, then all the demagoguery begins. They run an ad and said, this is what Bruce Dumont wants. And they show a veteran in a wheelchair trying to get into a hospital and someone shutting the door in his face and then, you know, him dying in an alleyway.
Yeah.
That's the way that politics works. That's demosclerosis.
But now,
this virus
aren't we seeing those pictures of pictures now of people who are literally dying because they didn't get the service at a VA facility?
But it's already happened. That Ron Kovic, Tim O'Brien, all the great writers who were veterans of the Vietnam War identified these problems with the VA. And then Walter Reed Hospital had so many problems. It was rat-infested during the Bush administration. Every time politicians say heads will roll, Americans get angry, but here we are again talking about Shinseki and the wait list, the discrepancies, and in 10 years it'll probably happen again.
Ron, I want to ask you a question based on something that we talked about last week on this program when we were talking about the VA. Why does the VA exist? It started as a good concept. The concept is too old and it's not working anymore. And I offered the thought, and you tell me whether you think there's any truth to this, is that one of the reasons why we want to have a segregated VA and a VA hospital is we want to somewhat hide the men who come back from any of our wars, and we don't want them populated into a hospital where we can see more and more men without limbs and more men with post-traumatic syndrome. And that literally one of the goals, and this may be a collective Republican-Democratic issue, we want to hide our veterans because we don't want them really to be seen by the general public, just as the Bush administration didn't want photographs of caskets coming home from the war. It reminds people of the tragedy of war and the price of war. Is there any truth to that?
There's a lot of truth to that. Just that the VA was really organized in 1930. It was a consolidation of varying programs, and the first Brigadier General Hines was out of the VA, which the hospital in Illinois is named after him. But you're spot on to the issue. When you go to a VA, there is a socioeconomic problem of integrating veterans into the mainstream. People go to the VA because they have lost their job, they don't have any insurance, and the VA is picking them up. So you have a socioeconomic issue where these folks will be coming in to the mainstream, and I think there will be a negative reaction to that because these people are unemployed. That's why the VA is there. They're to take care of them because they don't have insurance. That's the issue.
Maybe you underestimate people. I certainly, if I were waiting in my ophthalmologist office and there was a veteran beside me and he had no job, I wouldn't care. I don't know if it would. I guess it wouldn't bother me. But I agree with you. But maybe could it be that the government does a good job with the people who are really badly wounded? Maybe these centers that the VA has to deal with rehabilitation. Maybe they do that well. I don't know enough about the VA.
Well, the strength of the VA is more in outpatient care. I think they do a good job in that. The weakness is the inpatient care where people have chronic illnesses.
Oh,
this is
see,
where the backlog.
That's
where this problem is. And there is a shortage, believe it or not, of doctors coming in the VA. There are thousands of applicants out there that are empty because people are not applying for those jobs.
It's not that Professor Mike Miller or radio personality Bruce Dumont would care about seeing the wounded vet in the hospital. It's, I think, that the politician
right.
who pounds his chest and says that we must go to war when he'll never feel the effects of it. It's he cares. He doesn't want the American people to see the consequences of his decisions. I think that was true of Lyndon Baines Johnson during the Vietnam War. It was true of George W. Bush during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And it's still true now of Barack Obama. We're still fighting a war in Afghanistan. And whether there might be debates and arguments whether those wars were justified. But I don't think there's much room for debate that those presidents, respectively, did not want the American people to confront the consequences of those wars, the death, the destruction, the slaughter.
Anthony, do you agree with that?
Well, to some extent I do, but I don't think that they wanted to segregate veterans out. I mean, like it or not, most of the VA centers, for the most part, they do a phenomenal job. But the fact of the matter is they're also right now means tested. I mean, if you're a veteran, if you're employed already, they go by what you make in the first place, to whether or not to be seen or not. So, and when I was there as a veteran, before I became with the state, I had pretty good health care. I didn't have any problems with the VA at all. And I was at Hines VA out in Hines, Illinois.
Did you say that explain what you said about means tested?
They go by your income. Whatever your income level, for instance, let's say if you were
you get better service or worse service?
No, You have to pay a portion of the bills. You see, they go by what your income is at the time, and that's how you'll pay for the
service. But
again, so it's not like every veteran
that concept could happen at any hospital.
It's not like any veteran is out there just taking advantage of free health care. There is a cost associated.
It's just the issue of like the Affordable Care Act came into play because there were 45 million Americans uninsured. Same thing with veterans. When they come out, a lot of them, if they're unemployed, they have no insurance. So this is their fallback. They go to the VA. Once they reach a certain threshold of income level, then it's prorated, whatever the surface is. But they have health care that they need. Those who are catastrophically wounded and so forth, that's a different ballgame of the type of service that they get.
Do they get good service?
Well, apparently from this last report,
No. Those with the most catastrophic.
I think
based on your experience,
I can't answer that question with certainty that they are. To be honest with you, I just don't know.
Service is one thing, but backlog to get seen is another thing, and I think that's where the most part or this thrust this whole argument is coming from. The fact that they were padding the roles and saying that people were being seen when they were not being
seen.
Well,
we also if you also went to the my model of that you could go into any hospital, it could possibly be that every hospital will have a backlog just because there are so many people waiting to be seen, and that could destroy hospitals.
But the private
we've got to pause. You think the private sector is the answer to it all, right?
Could help, yeah.
1-800-723-8029. Bruce Dumont back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head to Grantham, New Hampshire, where Steve is listening to us on WNTK, one of our oldest affiliates. Go ahead. You're on the air, Steve. Nice to hear from New Hampshire.
Hi, Bruce and the others. By the way, hell of a hockey game going on right now in your place. The point is, clearly the government is screwed up in this VA thing. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. The government certainly is screwed up. But I don't know it's just the government. I think it's large. The larger you are as an organization, you screw up. General Motors with the recall, screw up, that's killed people. I don't know if you read the article in the New York Times today about Amazon selling drugs, allowing the sale of unlicensed drugs in the U.S., that haven't been approved by the FDA. I mean, it's just large business. So I think that really is the issue, is everything is getting larger, and as the larger it gets, other than in unique situations, like a Berkshire Hathaway maybe, it's difficult to manage and see all the things that go underneath.
Yeah, there's some evidence to support that. In economics, I don't want to bore you with some of the details, but we have a thing called a marginal cost curve, and it goes along, and all of a sudden it shoots up at around 90% of capacity. When firms get really, really large, they become harder and harder to manage, and prices go up very quickly towards that very large firm. And I think what happens in government, it gets so large, all of these inefficiencies begin to work their way in there. And that's why corporations sometimes will actually break off into other pieces, because it becomes more manageable if you have divisions as opposed to one, all decisions being made by one person in one location. So I think that the VA is suffering from a problem that it becomes so large. What if the veterans could have a voucher card like you would have in education? And you can say, if you want to go to the VA hospital, you go, no problem. But you can take this voucher to any hospital, any doctor, and it will be good for your service. And that way there'd be competition. The VA would try to work harder through human incentive to keep their customers so they keep their jobs. And I think everybody would be better served.
And also, just to go beyond this, I mean, we talk about the bureaucracy of government. There is the bureaucracy of nonprofit organizations. You have a variety of nonprofit organizations wanting to do good things for veterans, which is a good idea. Why can't some of them look for efficiencies? And if they're going to have benefits, have huge – I mean, I'm talking about fundraising, gala benefits. Let all those people that say they really love the troops, let them come and perform. Let people come and see these entertainers. And let's get a collective response from nonprofit organizations as well to pick up the ball and pick up the slack that will exist, because this is going to cost a lot of money. There's got to be some real creative thinking about all aspects of what we do. We primarily talk about this program about, you know, where government screws up. But there's so many things that have got to be examined. Another thing that always bothers me is, you know, libraries. I love libraries. Parks are important. Do we really need parks and libraries and parks and recreation and libraries in schools? I mean, it's the whole thinking of what goes into the buildings. What are the functions of these things that are going on? There's no real, you know, it's like looking at life and saying, we're going to start all over again. We say this is the greatest country on the face of the earth. Every Sunday night in this program, we're generally talking about something that government has done that's got screwed up. And yet we say it's the greatest country on earth, because some of these things should be basically trashed and restarted.
But you can go down that street, but in the end, it's easy to trash government and its inefficiencies because it's a blow to bureaucracy. But in the end, you know, corporations, and in America particularly, they can run a process that's streamlined, and they don't have all these other concerns. They don't have all these things that they have to be concerned with.
They have stockholders.
Yeah. They have shareholders and stockholders.
Who demand
But the fact of the matter is, they don't – yeah, absolutely. They demand efficiency.
Why can't taxpayers demand efficiency?
Therein lies the problem.
When taxpayers demand efficiency, they're called Tea Party people, and they're crazy.
Yes. Absolutely.
Also, keep in mind that when these corporations face these rising costs because they've lost control of the business, so to speak, they go out of business, and the VA doesn't go out of business, so there's no incentive to be efficient.
But to your point on nonprofit organizations, there's really a large number of them out there. The actor Gary Sinise, is a huge supporter, does concerts around the country. The Wounded Warriors Project is another one that's funded. Rolling Thunder supports the various programs. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of projects out there that should be coordinated better to help veterans, in need. So. And also to be a voice. I mean, you look at memorials. The purpose of the Vietnam Memorial and the others is not just to have the names. It's a sounding board to say we need to do more about our veterans. We can't sweep it under the carpet and forget about it like a politician. That's why politicians love to come and speak at the Vietnam Memorial, you know, as a platform. But to come and say something about Agent Orange, improving post-traumatic stress, improving VA hospitals, that's the platform.
Speaking of a platform, you recently participated in a program that really honored those who came, who gave their lives in Afghanistan and Iraq. Tell us about that experience.
This is, again, where it's cutting edge, to where we've got to move to the next generation here. We just read the names nonstop for 8 hours, May 24th, 2 days before Memorial Day, of 6,700 90 Iraq-Afghanistan veterans killed in action. Secretary Hagel kicked it off. General Petraeus, who was head of the 101 Airborne in Iraq 2003, read the names of over 200 of his troops that were killed in the war. I read names, and I'm contacting the people that I read the names about. We had the mother of the third person killed start off. His son was killed in Iraq, and hundreds of husbands, wives, sisters, brothers. It was a great occasion.
That was Ron Gibbs. Ron Gibbs, thank you for your service to your country and also for your continued service to your country in remembering veterans. Anthony Anderson, thank you very much for being with us as well. David Massey Ultra, right?
You got it.
And Mike Miller from DePaul University, thanks very much for being with us. This program is a Genemy production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Dan Dorfman and the ever-popular Todd Nebel for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Gentlemen, Dick Cavett.
He's one of the greatest television interviewers of all time. The legendary Dick Cavett is coming to Chicago.
There's a certain excitement in the air.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications presents a salute to Dick Cavett, Saturday, June 21st at 6:30.
But this is me. I'm letting it all hang out.
Spend an evening with a television legend.
Why don't we see how the show is?
A salute to Dick Cavett. Go to museum.tv for your tickets now.